This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
You're listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Lynn Mark. Transboundary waters, defined as the lakes and aquifers shared by multiple countries, support the livelihoods of millions of people around the world. As such, they can become sources of conflict. Now, as a maritime nation, we in Malaysia focus very much on the sea as a major source of our livelihoods, but we do in fact have just such a transboundary water conflict right in our backyard. So to help us understand this problem a bit better is Dr. Naho Muromachi, Associate Professor in Environmental Politics at King's College London. She's also co-author of the book Water Conflicts: Analysis for Transformation. Naho, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Lynn. This is a fantastic opportunity.
So first of all, talk us through some of the examples of transboundary water conflicts, kind of past and present, that you can think of.
Yeah, so I think close to home here in Malaysia, you have the Mekong River Basin in Southeast Asia, and it's a river that goes through six countries from China to Myanmar, going down to Laos, Cambodia, Thailand, and Vietnam. And these countries have been working together over the past close to half a century, to figure out how they can use these waters for irrigation, for hydropower development. But this is where the challenges emerge. So if you want to use the river for hydropower development, you build a dam, but that might have implications on other uses if you wanted to use it for irrigation or for agriculture, or if you want to look after the ecosystem health and thinking about fish fisheries, for example. In Cambodia, there's a big industry to ensure fisheries and be able to produce these fish for not just domestic markets, but also export markets. So if you don't have a healthy river, you're not going to have fish and therefore not be able to trade. So it's very much about how do you use water and what kind of competing uses there are. And quite often there are these big economic decisions that need to be made. So do you want to have electricity, hydropower, or do you want to have food, agriculture? Do you want to have various other types of commodities such as fish? So this is where a lot of the tensions have emerged in the Mekong River Basin, trying to figure out what is the sustainable development of the river? How can the river be a way to ensure economic development? Just going back to Malaysia, it's very interesting. You said that you are a maritime nation, but in many ways, you are also very much tied in with the transboundary rivers of the world, all parts of the world, for the fact that you import food. A lot of the times, many countries rely on international trade so that they can import food. By importing food, it means that you are using the water in places where the food is grown, where the agriculture products are grown. And these can often be in transboundary river basins, using transboundary lake waters or groundwater aquifers. And so by importing food and consuming food in Malaysia, you could, for example, be eating Brazilian soybeans, for example, or you could be eating rice from Vietnam, or you could be eating wheat from the US. And all of these things tie Malaysia into these very big, large transboundary river basins. So our choices of food, the way in which we do trade in Malaysia, is very much connected to these large river basins as well.
When it comes to talking about international efforts to mitigate these water conflicts, the UN has recorded 37 instances since 1948, so nearly 300 international agreements signed. But two-thirds of the world's transboundary waters actually don't have some kind of cooperative framework to guide them. Why is that the case? Are there challenges that we aren't seeing here, kind of competing domestic desires?
It's a very interesting question because there is so much interest in looking at water cooperation. So if you remember, the United Nations put out their SDG Sustainable Development Goals a couple of years ago. SDG 6 is exactly about water resources management, and it encourages transboundary water cooperation. So there's a big political commitment towards achieving SDGs, particularly SDG 6. So why can't we get it right? Why is it that we're not making progress towards...
Is it an individual country political will issue?
I think it's very much compounded. It's certainly about individual countries wanting to cooperate and committing to cooperate. So we need certainly political will to do that. But also coming to arrangements, whether in the form of treaties, take a long time. And I don't think we should discount the amount of time it takes to do the negotiations and get agreements in place. So the UN has a very groundbreaking framework convention. It's called the UN Water Courses Convention. And this lays out key international principles about how countries should cooperate and how countries, for example, should share information when they're going to start developing their river and engage in a dialogue or engage in consultation with each other. But this UN Water Courses Convention took many, many years, took decades to have it ratified and come into force. So despite the fact that there is a lot of interest in transboundary water cooperation, a lot of these do take time. And in many ways, it's also about how countries prioritize their political energy, because it's not just about water, right? There's also issues about military. There's also issues about regional stability, geopolitics. It could also be about internal domestic issues. We're right now in the middle of a pandemic. Many countries might prioritize healthcare and pandemic over international rivers. So it's also about the level of priorities countries give to thinking about water.
So when we think about these transboundary water issues, you propose in your book, Transboundary Water Politics in the Developing World, a new framework, which you've called the TWINS framework. So that stands for the Transboundary Waters Interaction Nexus. How does that differ from existing literature when it comes to helping us understand and analyze the situations surrounding these transboundary water disputes?
The TWINS framework was developed to really think through how countries engage with each other when it comes to discussing, negotiating these shared waters. A lot of the scholarly debate and a lot of the policy debate, for that matter, quite often talked about how countries were in a state of water conflict and how that these countries had to move into a state of water cooperation instead. So they said, you know, drop conflict and move into cooperation. And they had various policy instruments or policy steps one could take to move from conflict away and into cooperation. But when I started looking at various rivers throughout the world, including the Mekong and other parts such as South Asia, the Ganges, and also Southern Africa, I found that in many cases, these governments were constantly in a situation of conflict and cooperation. It wasn't so black and white. Countries, for example, would cooperate through technical committees and do joint surveys, but then at the high political negotiations level, they wouldn't necessarily agree and see eye to eye. So how would you call that situation? It's a mixture, definitely, of both conflict and cooperation. And the book was motivated by my sort of understanding to explain how conflict and cooperation very much are coexisting, and that you have to understand the dynamics rather than the severity of conflict or the increase of cooperation. Just looking at one or the other wasn't going to cut it. You had to really understand how these dynamics that included both conflict and cooperation emerged and changed over time. And the reason why these changed, for example, could be a change in trade. It could be a change in the geopolitical priorities. It could be a change in the ways economic development priorities were being made. So trying to just simply look at cooperation or simply looking at conflict and just seeing what are they doing regarding the negotiations didn't really explain the reality. Just by saying, oh, these committees were going forward, these kind of clauses of a treaty were being discussed, that didn't really help explain the bigger picture. I had to talk about the economy. I had to talk about energy. I had to talk about food. I had to talk about the levels of urbanization and the demand on water in order to explain how conflict and cooperation was constantly emerging, constantly changing over time.
I've been speaking with Dr. Naho Muromachi, Associate Professor in Environmental Politics at King's College London and co-author of the book Water Conflicts: Analysis for Transformation. Up next, a closer look at the water conflict in our backyard, the Mekong River. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
On the Breakfast Grill this morning is Dr. Naho Muromachi, Associate Professor in Environmental Politics at King's College London. She's also co-author of the book Water Conflicts: Analysis for Transformation. So Naho, earlier you'd mentioned the Mekong River Basin, which is, of course, the transboundary water conflict that is closest to us geographically. And we also discussed the TWINS framework, which you've proposed as a way to better understand the dynamics of cooperation and conflict which can exist in these transboundary water disputes. So with that TWINS framework in mind, help us paint a picture of the Mekong River Basin as how you understand it.
Right. So in many ways, a lot of the policy debate would say the Mekong was in a state of cooperation. All the Mekong countries agreed they were cooperating because they had an agreement in the 1990s on the sustainable development of the Mekong River. They set up a river basin organization between Laos, Cambodia, Thailand, and Vietnam. And this four governments came together, set up a river basin organization to do joint scientific studies. So when you look at these details, a lot of the policy debate and some of the scholarship, the academic research said that, oh, the Mekong was in a state of cooperation. It's almost like a model case for cooperation. This is also partly explained by the fact that these countries went through very different political histories. For example, if you remember in the 70s, there was war, there was the tensions around the Cold War as well. So a lot of commentators were saying that despite these big political differences between these countries and the Cold War happening, these four countries were able to come together and cooperate over water. That's true on one hand. But when I started to look more deeply into the Mekong, it didn't mean that just because they had an agreement in place, just because they had a river basin organizations, and just because they were doing scientific studies together, it didn't mean that they saw eye to eye on how water should be shared. There was always a lot of debate, and there was always a lot of reluctance on having clear rules. Because if you have clear rules, then your future water use might be curtailed, right? So a lot of governments, particularly the upstream governments, were rather hesitant to have these very clear rules on how mainstream water use should be allocated. So in many ways, historically, it was seen as an example of cooperation, but there were tensions underlying it. And by using the TWINS analysis, I could say that conflict and cooperation was coexisting. Now, fast forward to 2020, if you look at the news about the Mekong, you'll see a lot of headlines about the crisis of the Mekong around the dams and how the dams on the river is going to chop up the flow of this mighty Mekong River and cause havoc economically, but also ecologically as well. Again, if you apply the TWINS analysis, sure, there is a lot of contention over hydropower, and there's a lot of debate about what kinds of hydropower projects should go ahead, and countries are in negotiations over that. I wouldn't entirely call it a situation of water war or one of pure water conflict. because the countries are still negotiating. The countries do have various protocols for engaging and consulting and informing each other. So despite the headlines that you might see in the newspaper articles about the crisis or the impending Mekong water wars, actually there's also a lot of work towards trying to figure out what is the best way forward, what kind of debates and negotiations need to happen. So again, it's not so black and white, and the twins analysis helps us understand the levels of conflict and cooperation that are emerging and changing over time.
I do want to come back to whether or not, you know, this, we're actually going to see kind of some resolution to this. But before we get to that, you mentioned that upstream countries particularly will not want to see their efforts curtailed. And this is something that you touch on in your books, right? So the concept of hydrohegemony and the difference that the placement of a country in relation to the transboundary water in question, how that can affect its approach and its essentially its power over the conflict that or the cooperation that may result. So could you perhaps give us a little bit more detail into this?
That's such a great point, Lynn, and it's interesting how hydrohegemony works in the river basin. So hydrohegemony means that there is one country that has overwhelming control over the other countries sharing the same river. And quite often this could be as a result of geographical location. If you're closer to the water source, if you're upstream, well, you have already an advantage. It's much easier to control the water resources. If you build a dam upstream, well, you are able to store it a lot easier than a downstream state. But the interesting thing about power and the control over water resources is that the hydrohegemon can't just rely on its geography. It also has to use other forms of influence and persuasion so that it can secure water resources. So what I mean by this is that hydrohegemony works through multiple ways. It could be through being an upstream state and being able to be close to the water resource, but it could also mean that it's reliant on technical capacity. So if you don't have the technical capacity and the know-how and the finances to build a dam, it doesn't really matter if you're upstream or downstream. If you can't build the dam, you can't build the dam. But also the key important aspect of this is soft power. A lot of countries exercise soft power constantly in negotiations. They do this so that they can convince others to come to an agreement. They use soft power to persuade others during negotiations so that they can come to an agreement that is favorable to their water needs and priorities for water use. So hydrohegemony is a combination of both hard power and soft power. It's not just the power to secure water through infrastructure or through military threat or even economic threat of sanctions, for example. It's also about the soft power to convince and persuade other agreements to sign the agreement, for example, to sign up to this agreement to establish a river basin organization that will help ensure that you can use water in the way you prioritize it as a sovereign state, as the nation state. So hydrohegemony is in many ways very fascinating. It shows how countries do diplomacy. It shows how countries talk to each other and are in constant negotiation with each other.
So coming back to the point that you were discussing earlier, if we take the Mekong River Commission, for example, there has been criticism of the commission saying that it is not necessarily the most effective body when it comes to regulating the actions affecting the Mekong River. So if that's not necessarily an effective body, will we be able to see an effective, internationally agreed upon framework governing the Mekong?
Yeah, no, so I think you're right about the criticisms about the Mekong River Commission. There have been comments made about the Mekong River Commission as not being able to push forward with some of these ideas about sustainable development. It sounds great on plan, but when it comes to the implementation, becomes very difficult. But the reason why that happens, and I And the reason why the Mekong River Commission seems to have limitations is not because the organization is not well set up, or it's not because the people working there are not prioritizing the right things. Actually, it's because this river basin organization is subject to the sovereignty of the four countries. There might be great scientific implementation and studies that are being carried out by the Mekong River Commission, but the political decisions rest with the four governments. Now, what's going to happen in the future? How can we come to a good resolution? I think one of the key issues or the key things to think about is figuring out what the water is going to be used in the future, and how the four countries and actually the whole of the Mekong River basin is going to prioritize it. There's competing demands, as I say, about electricity that's underpinned by urbanization and further industrialization. The countries are moving into a more accelerated form of economic development. So people's lifestyles are changing, right? And it's also partly impacted by climate change. We don't know what the future hydrology is going to be like. So we need to have a level of resilience to these changes. And I think there's also a very important third element to look after our ecological health. The Mekong is so rich in biodiversity, and it's very important to have a healthy ecosystem to support livelihoods as well. People rely on it for their livelihoods. So thinking about not just water for humans, but also water for the ecosystem, and thinking about the health of water bodies is also important. So I think if we can think about these three aspects of the competing water uses, thinking about the ways in which uncertainty lies ahead in the future, thinking about environmental health, ecological health, then we might be able to start seeing what are the better options that we have. And that could motivate the states to come together and work together as well.
Well, thank you very much for joining us this morning, Naho. It's been a pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
I've been speaking with Dr. Naho Muromachi, Associate Professor in Environmental Politics at King's College London and co-author of the book Water Conflicts: Analysis for Transformation. This has been The Breakfast Grill. I'm Lynn Mark, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.